This podcast features graphic details of real events taken from letters written by inmates convicted of murder. Listener discretion is advised.
We're using sounds to see. A clock ticking in the living room. The hum of the refrigerator. Everything is in slow motion.
These are the written words of Florida inmate number 451642, Kevin Jeffries.
We move with practiced and precise movements, only inches, because the house is pitch black.
They're taken from letters that he wrote to us in 2018.
We hear the slight snore coming from the master bedroom. Everything is just right for what we're doing.
My name is Zoe Hines, and Kevin Jeffries is one of over 2,000 inmates that my colleague Ned Parker and I have corresponded with in our work as documentary filmmakers.
Mayville 911.
This is Letters from a Killer, a Podimo podcast. Episode 7, Graphic Content Warning.
If you're choosing to listen to this podcast, it's likely you and I share some similar interests. There's something about human nature, criminal behaviour, the process of justice, or more likely a combination of all three, that has led you here, just as it led me to work in this field. But for me, and I believe for most true crime fans, there is also a fine, elusive, and personal line when it comes to consuming these stories. A point at which the coverage is simply too graphic, or a case just too upsetting. A moment where you suddenly feel this has gone too far, and you're reminded sharply that a list of gruesome details should never total a human being's epitaph. Which is why we want to be clear that this episode carries the most sincere of graphic content warnings. Because in the case of Wallace Reed Scott, who suffered at the hands of our letter writer, Kevin Jeffries, we have to discuss the violence he endured and the horrific moments he was subject to. Because Kevin Jeffries' letters go into detail about every moment of that suffering. They reduce the horrific end of this human being's life to a macabre inventory of pen strokes.
The letters that feature in this episode tell an unbelievably tragic story. It involves a criminal act against an elderly and defenseless man for no apparent reason apart from financial reward. And yet, the level of sadistic acts that were carried out against this vulnerable victim and the items that were eventually stolen show that this was in no way what you might call a common burglary.
These letters raise important themes, including substance abuse and whether the perpetrators were in their right minds at the time of the incident to the extent that they realised what they were actually doing. And there's also a very interesting theme raised by the accomplices and the fact that two out of three of them were related.
The letters contain details that are difficult to listen to. So please, in this instance, do be especially advised.
Let's hear the tragic events of Kevin Jeffries' case file.
Letters from a Killer. Case file. The following details are taken from official news reports and court documents. On the night of April 4th, 2013, in the picturesque city of Lynn Haven, Florida, Kevin Jeffries took part in the burglary, torture, and murder of a 90-year-old war veteran. Jeffries, along with his cousin David Challender, broke into the house of Wallace Reed Scott, a man who was nearly completely deaf, with the intention of robbing him. Jeffries' aunt and Challender's mother, Sherry K. Mercer, was the old man's live-in carer until a few weeks before his death. Jeffries and Challender had both met Reed Scott previously and believed that Reed Scott had money and valuable guns in his house. Both Jeffries and Challender had reportedly been taking the drug crystal meth for over a month. On entering the house, Reed Scott awoke and proved more of a match than they had expected as he began fighting Challender. Jeffries intervened and wrestled Reed Scott to the ground. He then allegedly stomped on the 90-year-old's head until Reed Scott became unconscious, at which point the cousins tied their victim up with a lamp cord and set about robbing his house. They were joined in the night by Jeffrey's girlfriend, Ashley Griffin, and the trio stayed in the house until early that morning. They were reportedly smoking marijuana and meth throughout their time there. When they eventually decided to leave, the trio took only an armful of items: a ring, 4 guns, a clock, and $100 in cash. Wallace Reed Scott didn't survive the night.
This victim was 90 years old. He was a veteran, and he was a vulnerable individual who took his assailants by surprise by not being quite as vulnerable as they had expected. I think it's very natural to make some immediate judgments about the kind of people you're dealing with as soon as you hear that they targeted an old man because they anticipated he wouldn't fight back.
And I think another point to note is that these three individuals had been abusing drugs for an extended period of time. And there is certainly a scarily wired drug-induced mania that seems to be playing out here. And it's unclear to what degree these people were conscious of what they were doing, but through the story told in Jeffrey's letters, it does seem that they were indeed conscious of their acts and that this was a planned invasion and potentially a planned act of violence.
Let's hear our first extract from Jeffrey's letters. Initially, we asked Jeffrey's about his background, and he writes about how he was brought up in a foster home as a baby, along with his brother and sister.
Quotes from Jeffrey's letters are read by an actor, but these are his words as written to us from prison.
I learned to hate real quick. Not just an emotional hate, but a devouring and all-consuming kind. It caused me to close up, to shut people out. I was not made to feel love like one should. Instead of being showered with love, I got the exact thing I already felt. I was talked down to, shunned, and abused.
In his letters to us, Jeffries talks about being beaten as a child, but he also tells us about an incident that has a very sinister undertone when you think about the murder of the elderly victim, Wallace Reed Scott, for which Jeffries was eventually tried.
My grandfather ended up passing out from drinking. He was on a wooden chair. My sister got me to help her tie him up to the chair so that he couldn't beat on me anymore. We left him that way for many hours, till my mom came home.
I find it really chilling that Jeffries, knowing he committed his crime against a 90-year-old man, has chosen to insert this particular anecdote in his letters here. The manner of the restraint and the profile of the individual being restrained are eerily similar. We often ask ourselves whether letter writers could be making these connections subconsciously, whether they could be unaware of the parallels. But in this instance, it seems so obvious. They've got to be similarities that Jeffries himself recognises.
I'm not sure which is more concerning, the possibility that he knows that these are parallels that we will draw and that he's trying to point us towards them, almost as if he's pleased with this account? Or is it more chilling that he's so unaware of himself that he's telling us about this event in his letters without actually seeing any connection at all?
Is he perhaps framing the incident he was convicted of as some kind of flashback to this incident where he was a traumatised child and a victim? More sinisterly, could he perhaps be saying, look, it wasn't such a stretch for me to tie this man up because I'd done it before? Or perhaps we're looking at the complete opposite. Is this Jeffries trying to say, now you know just how awful and triggering killing this man must have been for me because of what happened in my past? Jeffries never returns to this story, and he never contextualises it.
In his next letter extract, Jeffries goes on to talk about how he was allegedly abused by his mother, and he suggests that this may stem from being
born with my umbilical cord around my throat. My mom had to have an emergency C-section. My dad is the one person who always tried to get me to open up. He always tried to show me love by keeping my mom from punishing me, or talking to me negatively, calling me things like bastard or son of a bitch, good for nothing. All types of stuff that a child of any age shouldn't be called on a daily basis. There was never encouragement or praise for good things done. It was always abuse. It did not change until I was in my teens and when my mom went to prison.
It's quite a connection to draw, this idea that the act of literally being born somehow connects to the violence that was administered to him by his mother. This indicates to me that Jeffrey's understanding of his place in the world is perhaps quite a distorted view of himself and the people that surround him.
Interesting that Jeffrey's also mentions his mum went to prison when he was a teenager here. We know that Jeffrey's cousin, David Challender, was a co-defendant in the murder. So we're starting to see a picture of criminality surrounding Kevin Jeffrey's in his immediate family and circle. I've recently been doing quite a lot of research into what's known as familial criminality and the statistics surrounding family incarceration. Of course, not everyone with parents in prison goes on to commit crime themselves. But what is interesting is the lack of support available for young people in those environments who want to break the cycle and the grim statistics that emerge as a result. The original seminal study into this issue, released in the early 2000s, found that just 10% of families were responsible for the majority, two-thirds, of convictions in the sample study. So that takes gangs, organised crime families, etc. into account. But with Kevin's mum being in prison as a teenager and a clear history of family violence and the connection to David Challender, the family context and their criminal activities is definitely a factor to consider here.
It is becoming clear from what Jeffreys is writing to us that the picture he paints here of his childhood upbringing is one we do wonder where he might have found any kind of positive encouragement or inspiration in his life. When speaking of his role models and influences, he writes,
"I wanted to be a pilot. I wanted to join the Air Force and fly fighter jets. I'm not entirely sure what inspired this, other than one day at school, a recruiter was telling us about the Air Force. He was in uniform, had all kinds of medals and other fancy type stuff. I realized things were so much bigger in the world I was living in. I did have influences, yes. And they were all bad."
It seems that the man in the Air Force uniform was just a fleeting moment of inspiration for the young Jeffreys. And I think it stands out for its uniqueness in his recollections. This could be the one and only time that he had a role model that he felt he could aspire to. And this was just somebody who came into his school, just somebody who happened to be wearing a uniform and looking respectable. But it caused him to write these words.
"I realized things were so much bigger than the world I was living in."
In the context of Jeffrey's experiences and the fact that he went on to spend his life incarcerated for murder, those words take on a real resonance. If all you see is criminality, all you see is a certain kind of behaviour, then it does get argued this will influence who you become, and that only lends more credence to the familial criminality discussion.
Let's hear our next extract from Jeffrey's letters and listen to his responses when he's asked about the day of the murder itself.
"Myself and my cousin, we were super tuned because we've been doing meth for the past 45 days, so we were focused. But we're in fast forward, so to speak. We're hyped up. Now, during this period, I again tried to convince my cousin and my fiancé to change their minds, to not go through what we are plotting on doing. See, we all know the owner. My aunt was his caregiver for quite some time. My cousin, her son, lived there with them for 6 months, roughly, so he knows the house. This is only my second time ever being at the house, and the first time was only for 5 minutes. The man was home, so we were not going to get off easy."
The fact that it transpires here that Jeffrey's aunt was the caregiver of the victim, Wallace Reed Scott, is without doubt a big revelation. This wasn't a random house invasion. This was a planned burglary with multiple family members involved in the plotting of it.
Over the course of our research, we discovered that Sherry Mercer, who was David Challender's mum, and Deborah Cupp, another aunt of Jeffrey's, These women were also convicted of credit card fraud against the victim, Wallace Reed Scott. So this really is a family web with Wallace Reed Scott right in the centre. This person has been identified as a potential victim twice by the same family.
Now, this is obviously abhorrent. A 90-year-old man who this family have considered to simply be a source of illicit revenue for them. But just to look at it from the other side, we should try and understand who these people are. What caused them to live their lives believing that it was acceptable to take advantage of the vulnerable like this?
Jeffries does explain that the situation for both him and his girlfriend Ashley and for David Challender, his cousin, was pretty desperate at the time of the incident. Ashley and Jeffries were about to be homeless, jobless. Everything they owned was in storage. They needed money because Ashley had been in trouble for bad checks. They were having to pay Jeffries' dad rent. They were trying to keep the repossession people from taking their car. So financial gain was undoubtedly a factor behind the committal of this crime.
Because all of us were so desperate and out of time with no light at the end of the tunnel, we got together to try to find a means to an end. It was never to support drug habits. It was never out of greed. It was only to get back on level ground, to get out of the hole we were all in.
I think it's time that we heard how Kevin Jeffries explains what happened on the night of the murder in his letters.
This is very painful, because for me, it's not just words on this paper. For me, every sound, smell, everything I touched or touched me, every hair on my body, feels every moment with every flashback of this day. This is really what convinces me to go in and to follow through. I knew we could still steal stuff and leave without ever waking him up. So that was my plan. That's what's going through my head. One of the other downfalls about meth, you're going to be going and thinking 100 miles per hour. You have to, because if you don't, if you try to slow down after being up for days and after doing so much that you'll crash, you won't wake up for days, and we didn't have days to spare. Each of us had to have the money we needed in days.
Despite the drug-induced state, Jeffries and Challender waited for another hour or two before gaining entry through the kitchen window.
At this point, everything is in slow motion. We move with practiced and precise movements, only inches, because the house is pitch black. We're using sounds to see. A clock ticking in the living room. The hum of the refrigerator. We hear the slight snore coming from the master bedroom. Everything is just right for what we're doing. The lights all of a sudden come on. Then, out of nowhere, I hear my cousin. He's yelling for me to help him. He was fighting with the owner, trying to get the gun from the table. What seems like hours pass as I watch, not fully comprehending what I'm seeing. Again, my cousin yells to help. He's having a hard time trying to subdue the man. So without thinking, other than helping my cousin, I grab the owner and yank him towards the other side of the bed. Everything that happened next only lasted about 2 minutes. I go to restrain his arms. That's when my cousin comes over to the bed and starts hitting him. Well, I didn't feel that was necessary. I knew I could hold him, and we could tie him up and not have to worry about him. So I yanked him to the floor, and we both hit it hard. Before I could get out from under him, my cousin was there, hitting and kicking him and me because I was trying to get out and up. So I was really in the way. Because of this, I did the only thing I could, grabbed hold of the owner, and rolled to the middle of the floor. Now I'm on top, and able to get up. And when I did, I took one step forward and stomped on the owner's head. He instantly started to snore. He was out cold, which was good, because now the whole thing was over. There was no more fighting.
The way that Jeffries describes how they navigated the house in complete silence, crawling inch by inch in pitch black. This is a novel. This is creative, descriptive writing.
you come away from reading that feeling as if you've almost been a witness to these events. You've somehow been involved in this incredibly unpleasant experience yourself because of the way he writes, because he's using the present tense. He's using decorative adjectives. He's painting the most immediate of pictures for us and inserting us into that environment.
What we know happened in this instance is that Jeffries and Challenger used a lamp to tie the old man's hands, and they used a belt to tie his feet, and they pulled a sheet over him so that he couldn't see. And it was at this point that Jeffries then calls his fiancée, Ashley, who apparently arrives within minutes.
And they go and sit in the car and smoke a joint while David Challenger is still inside continuing this brutality. They don't call 911. They don't leave the scene. They sit there knowing that this old man is injured but alive, and it's horrific.
As his letters continue, Jeffries explains how the cousins then tried to get the bank account and debit card details from the old man.
He only asked to be set up and wanted to know why we were doing this.
And this is where the event escalated from a household burglary or even a violent robbery into something far, far more extreme.
I had only the money on my mind, and it wasn't there anyway. By this point, my cousin had messed with the owner. He was going to give him so many minutes, and then he was going to stick a plunger in his ass. He even had a pair of scissors that he made effort to cut his genitals off. This I seen firsthand. We all had also smoked some more meth and weed, mixed, and I think it's only because I was so into what was needed that I remained blind to the actions and violence towards the owner.
By this point, the trio had been in the house for several hours, and it's the middle of the night.
Jeffries claims that close to 5 a.m., he went to ask the owner if he wanted to go to hospital.
He said to untie him and sit him up, so I did. I cut the cords off and sat him against the foot of the bed. He never moved again. I kept going in, talking to him, because I felt bad at what had happened. I explained to him that it was not supposed to end up like it did. I tried to be decent to him. I felt his chest to see if he was breathing or to feel a heartbeat. I couldn't. I went into the study where my cousin and Ashley were talking. With tears streaming down my face, I told him, I think he was dead.
We've already discussed the fact that this is an absolutely harrowing account of a horrific crime. The moment that I actually can't get out of my head is the bit where Kevin Jeffries writes about going in and checking on Wallace Reed Scott. What you're talking about here is the last moment where a person's life could have been saved, and he did nothing.
When we are investigating stories like this, it is our role to try to remain objective and to look at the broader picture. And I have to say that in this instance, I find it impossible to do so. I find myself incandescent with rage at the way that Jeffries tries to write to absolve himself of responsibility or to try to present himself in any way as if he is the good guy here. It is unclear if the vile acts which were carried out on the victim were conducted solely by Challenger or by Jeffries, or if his death was caused by a combination of brutal acts undertaken by both individuals. But Jeffries claims here to have had any concern for the victim simply ring hollow for me. The only thing that I think is clear is that neither of them did anything to help this man. So let's now hear how Kevin Jeffries' actions and those of his co-defendants were judged when they eventually came to court.
Letters from a Killer. The Verdict. The following details are taken from official news reports and court documents. May 22nd, 2013. Jeffries, Griffin, and Challenger were indicted for first-degree murder, armed burglary of a dwelling, and armed robbery. After the cases were served, the state proceeded against Jeffries in a one-week trial. Challenger took a plea deal from the state in return for a life sentence. Griffin, Jeffries' girlfriend, who by that time was his fiancée, pleaded guilty to second-degree murder, principal to armed burglary, and principal to armed robbery. In exchange for cooperating with the state, she received a 20-year sentence. She testified on behalf of the state during Jeffries' trial, but Challenger did not testify. Jeffries was convicted of capital murder and given the death sentence in 2014. In January 2018, this was overturned and transferred to a sentence of life in prison.
These letters have been incredibly difficult to hear. With years spent behind bars where he could present his story in any number of different ways, Kevin Jeffries chooses to tell it almost like it's a fictional event. This is him genuinely, I think, trying to put his best spin on things. And it's just awful to read, and it's horrific to listen to. In no way, at least to my mind, do these letters convince you to feel any level of sympathy or empathy or understanding towards Jeffries. And as far as I'm concerned, I cannot imagine a human being on the planet who would feel that way. And for me, the question is not why did this happen, but why share these details at all? What are the reasons for hearing these letters read out by an actor in this podcast? Are we risking straying into the territory of true crime for entertainment's sake, or is there something useful that exploring the details of such a case can teach us? The stories we look at because we think there is a larger social issue at play. There is something that we can learn, and we thought very carefully about whether that was the case here and if this was a case that should be included in the series at all. But ultimately, what this case does is to help us place the other stories into some sort of context. The Jeffries case for me is just so horrific that I think it highlights how, no matter how much we might struggle to initially comprehend the motivations of the other killers who we've heard from in this series, there is at least something in those cases that is human in what drove some of them at least to do such awful things. But for me, there is almost nothing recognisably human in Jeffries' account here.
In this episode of Letters from a Killer, we've explored the horrific events that led to the death of a vulnerable and elderly man, and how this is recounted in the explicit letters of one of the people convicted of his murder. Kevin Jeffries claims to have had a troubled childhood with a lack of any kind of positive role model.
I did have influences, yes. And they were all bad.
He also claims to have been driven by money troubles, drug addiction, and family pressures, which led him to committing the crime.
Because all of us were so desperate, we got together to try to find a means to an end.
We've discussed the concept of familial criminality in relation to the plotting and undertaking of the violent acts that featured in this case.
I tried to convince my cousin and my fiancé to change their minds, to not go through what we were plotting on doing.
But what I struggle with here is how a desperate act of burglary could possibly have escalated into becoming an act of torture and aggressive violence that ended the life of a 90-year-old man.
Next time on Letters from a Killer. Deadly coercion.
The murder is a tough one. I'm at Judy's house, waiting for her call. She's at the victim's apartment. She calls me and tells me it's a go. Plan A was to drown him. Plan B was to stab him. Judy knew I had the knife.
Letters from a Killer was hosted by Zoe Hines and Ned Parker, and is a Podimo podcast by Transistor Films. Support the show by sharing on social media and following the podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts.